Right, Biblical Prophecy and Postmillennialism. With the 31st part, it's part 30 of Historical Expectations According to the Bible, and part 9 of the Eschatology of the Book of Revelation. We're on chapter 9. Quote from the Westminster Confession, chapter 3, section 2. Although God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, yet has he not decreed anything because he foresaw it as future, or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. In Revelation 8, we saw four trumpets sound. And those trumpets were talking about the judgments to fall upon the Roman Empire, the Imperial Roman Empire. It is notable that the judgments that are falling on them, and even the judgments that we'll see in chapter 9, a lot of them are very much comparable to the plagues that fell on Egypt. The reason is because God is, in fact, pouring out his judgments upon those who are resisting his word. Those in the Western Roman Empire, in chapter 8, we saw really what was the demise of the Western Roman Empire and the end of Imperial Rome. We saw that there was, in fact, a beginning. Really, it marks the beginning of that period of time when the Roman Empire itself is going to be divided into the 10 toes of Daniel's image, or Nebuchadnezzar's image, we read of in Daniel. There's an end, and there's judgment coming on the West. Chapter 9 is taking us from looking at the West, Western Roman Empire, to looking at the Eastern Roman Empire. So if we remember that this prophecy is an unfolding of the history of the church, and an unfolding of the history of the world as it pertains to the church. Remember, the church is at the center of history, and Revelation is really taking us from the time of the Roman Empire down to the end of time. So we see developments that were prophesied in the book of Daniel. But those developments are not yet come into play. The first four trumpets are judgments, as I say, against the Western Empire. The next two trumpets, and we're going to talk about them, the fifth and the sixth, these two trumpets are aimed at the eastern part of the Roman Empire. So, around the year 476, the Roman Empire is reduced, seriously reduced, and it enters into a state of turmoil. In the course of its reorganization, it's going to go from being the Imperial Roman Empire to the Holy Roman Empire, what we would call the Holy Roman Empire, which is really the origin of the Roman Church, Roman Catholic Church. So the Roman Church is going to rise in the West, but now we're going to look at what happens in the East. This is all really telling us the same story across the history of the Roman Empire. So the first four trumpets are telling us the story of what's going on in the West. Now we need to see an overview of what's going on in the East. Before we go back, eventually, go back and tie into the West again and see the really what is the rest of the story in the West. So we're going to see under these two trumpets in the East a lot more history. And the reason is that although the center of the Roman Empire is removed from the West around 476, we have the Byzantine Empire continuing in the East, the purposes of God with respect to his church, and particularly with respect to the rise of Antichrist in the West, that's a little bit more involved than what we'll see going on in the East. There's a division in Antichrist, and so we're going to see the Eastern Antichrist here in chapter 9. Chapter 9 is going to deal with the Byzantine Empire and with the rise of Islam and the effect that it has on the Byzantine Empire and really the strength that Islam exerts in the history of the world. So Islam has its own life expectancy, its own course that it's going to run. And it will run that course predominantly with respect to the Eastern Roman Empire and the nations that occupy the territory that was the Byzantine Empire. There's a reason why Islam really has never gotten outside of that area. And we'll see that. Even in the prophecy, they're sort of tied to that area. So we want to begin with Revelation 9:1.
Revelation 9, verse 1. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit.
Now, there are three things that the Apostle John says he observes. The first is a fifth angel sounding, presumably a fifth trumpet. And this is really the first woe that is in the Eastern Empire. Along with that, he sees a star falling from heaven to earth. And that star receives a key to the bottomless pit. Now, that fallen star does not exactly represent either, for example, it doesn't represent Boniface, I think the third, who was a pope at that time. Nor does it represent Muhammad. A star falling from heaven to earth represents, in this case, the fall of an ecclesiastical figure from a place in the church to a place in the world. And the one who is involved, or who's in view here, is believed by a lot of expositors, and I tend to agree with this. I don't see any reason for looking elsewhere. There was a monk, a Nestorian monk named Sergius. Why is Sergius important? Well, Sergius is the one who allegedly wrote the Quran. We know Muhammad was illiterate. We also know that a lot of the Quran has themes that we find in the Bible. So that whoever wrote it was familiar, from time to time, at least, with the Bible, and particularly with the New Testament. That tells us that we should be looking for, in essence, an apostate from the Christian religion. And Sergius is the one who in history fits this best. This idea that he receives a key to the bottomless pit is also significant, I think. In Islam, the key and this idea of judgment figure very prominently. In fact, the image of a key is one of the few things that you will make out on some of their early Islamic artwork, carvings. One of the early Islamic cities has over their gate a key dangling. That was their symbol. As much as you would associate or the symbol of the cross has come to be associated with Christianity, early on the symbol of a key is associated with Islam. So we need to ask then some questions based on Revelation 9:2. So let's look at Revelation 9:2.
Revelation 9, verse 2. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, and the smoke as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit.
All right, so we know that what is done, this fallen star uses this key to open the pit, the bottomless pit. The result is that there's a smoke arising out of it that darkens the sun in the air. Now, the smoke is telling us that what's being let out is a system of delusion. What it's doing is it's darkening the light. And it's also smothering. It's darkening the air. The air we breathe. You know, if the air is in fact deprived of its properties as air, it can kill you. You know, if you are in a room and it fills with smoke, it can kill you. It's, more people in fires die from smoke inhalation then a lot of times die from the fires themselves. Smoke inhalation tends to get you. And that's what's involved here. This is something which is darkening the light, and it's also smothering. It's creating an atmosphere where there can't be life. So there's not light, and there's no atmosphere for life. Revelation 9:3.
Revelation 9:3, and there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power.
So what we have is, out of the smoke comes a swarm of locusts. And again, this is reminiscent, like the plagues the judgments in the previous chapter, it's very much reminiscent of the kind of plague that comes upon Egypt. It's also a plague, actually, which comes upon the people of God in several ways. And in order to understand what the locusts are symbolizing, we can look at Exodus 10, verses 14 and 15, as well as Joel 1, 4 to 6.
Exodus 10, verses 14 and 15. And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt and rested in all the coasts of Egypt. Very grievous were they.
Before them there were no such locusts as they, neither after them shall be, for they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they did eat every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left, and there remained not any green thing in the trees or in the herbs of the field through all the land of Egypt.
Joel 1, verses 4 through 6. That which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left hath the canker worm eaten, and that which the canker worm hath left hath the caterpillar eaten. Awake, ye drunkards, and weep, and howl, all ye drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation is come up upon a land strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the teeth of a great lion.
We're going to come back to the teeth of the lion there, because that comes up here in our imagery as well. Locusts represent a destroying army. In this case, the destructive followers of Muhammad. The people that originally adopt Islam are called Saracens. And they actually originate in the land where biblical locusts are found. So, if we were to look for the homeland for locusts in Bible times, it's the same homeland where these Saracens arise. Locusts is an image we see in Joel being used of a devouring army, an invading, devouring army, destructive, leaving nothing in its wake, going through and destroying everything before it. Now, if we ask why they're described as scorpions, we're going to look at Ezekiel 2:6.
Ezekiel 2:6, and now, son of man, be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words, though briars and thorns be with thee. And thou dost dwell among scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor be afraid at their looks, that they be a rebellious house.
Yeah, thou dost dwell among scorpions, they're a rebellious house. It means that they're wicked and impenitent men. Now, we're going to see in a moment that they are under some restraint. They don't have free reign. But they're wicked. They are destructive. Their course is a destructive one. Revelation 9, verse 4.
And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads.
So the first limitation that's set upon them is they're only permitted to harm those who are not sealed. In other words, they're not going to get to the elect of God. They cannot get the elect of God. The Spirit of God has gone forth and set a seal upon the foreheads of the people of God. Remember that lull before the trumpets began to sound. So at the end of heathen Rome, we had a lull with the conversion of Constantine. But with the rise of Imperial Rome, Christian Rome in the West, what we had were other kinds of issues that developed. But there were people who were sealed in their foreheads. Well, here we see that in the East, the same situation is, in fact, in force. When God went forth sealing the foreheads of the people, those people were the ones who were exempted from what is being inflicted by this judgment being released under the fifth trumpet. We're going to look now at Ezekiel 4:6 and look at that in combination with Revelation 9:5.
Ezekiel 4:6. When thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year.
Revelation 9, verse 5. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion.
when he striketh a man.
So Ezekiel 4:6, like other places in Scripture, should help us understand the timing. Not only do these swarms of locusts, not only do they have this restriction that they can't harm those who are sealed, but now we see that they're given another constraint. It's a time constraint. We're told the time of their continuance will be 5 months. Now, if we understand that each month represents 30 days, 5 months of 30 days, we have 150 days. And each of these is a year. So the continuance is going to be for 150 years. Well, how do we reckon that in the East? What's going on at this time? In the year 612 AD, we know this. Muhammad began to preach in Mecca. So Islam arises as a public religion in the year 612. And it begins its spread. It finishes that in the year 762. In the year 762 AD, the city of Baghdad, which in Arabic is called the City of Peace, the Persian refers to it as being more of a, I think, a paradise or something. But Baghdad is established, and the caliph, the ruler, the Islamic ruler, begins to rule and reign from there. So the initial early spread of Islam, where it gets its foothold in the Middle East, is in that first 150 years. From the time Muhammad begins to preach in Mecca till the establishing of Baghdad. The torment of the scorpion, that refers to the fact that these Islamic invaders, as they're spreading out of Mecca, as they're going from place to place, the Muslims are inflicting misery upon their victims as they go in from place to place. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in a moment, just what they did and how they did it. Because their method is interesting. And it was very, very effective. Now, to this day, this period, or this area, I should say, from Mecca to Baghdad, is all predominantly Islamic. So it's the center of the Islamic world being established in this 150 years.
Revelation 9:6. And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them.
Okay, in those days, that is during this 150-year period, as they're going forth, what it means is that the torments that are being inflicted as they're going are so severe that men actually desire death to put an end to all the torment that they were bringing as they spread. And this, I think, is a very important thing to remember, that Islam, from the very beginning, has been spread by sword. Islam, from the very beginning, has propagated itself, not at gunpoint, although later it will be, from the beginning at the point of a sword. You know, they would go into places and demand that people convert, if people did not convert, very often they were killed and their things were taken. If you did convert, they had another plan for you altogether. What they did is they advanced those who converted it from one city would be taken into the invading army. And they would leave behind members of the invading army to repopulate the town, to take the women and have children and raise children and establish an Islamic community. And then at some later invasion, perhaps several towns away, when you've proven that you're a good Muslim, you would be left behind. You had converted maybe several towns ago. Now you're going to be left behind to take as many of the women, local women, as you want, to have children and to raise them to support Islam. So what they did is they really reformed entire communities and redefined entire families. And they did it at the edge of the sword. And that really, I think, is at least partially what's in view in verse 7. And following, there's some interesting things here. So look at Revelation 9, 7.
Revelation 9, verse 7. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men.
So we read here of locusts prepared to battle. They're like horses arrayed for battle. That's what they really are. It's horses. And they've got crowns on their heads. Now, the crowns on their heads may refer to the turbans that the Muslims were wearing, and a lot of them continue to wear today. But it may well have to do, and I think more likely has to do, with the fact of this conquest that's going on as they go from place to place, this outspreading of the establishing of Islam. Now, the significance of this verse is found in this. The Saracens, the Arabians, are a people very early on who were known to excel in horsemanship. They were not looking for people riding horses in a culture or from a place where it would have been less common. Now, the Egyptians, for example, were not fielding large cavalries. The Egyptians had horses, but they also had chariots. A lot of the other early peoples had chariots. The Arabians, the Saracens, were not only excellent in their horsemanship, but when they talk about horses prepared unto battle, what they had in mind is this. Battle horses were particularly trained. Battle horses could stop at the slightest command. They would stop. Battle horses were trained to walk sideways. Battle horses were trained to turn around, do a complete turnaround on a dime. Battle horses were trained that if the enemy fell before them, the horses were actually trained to stamp on the enemies to kill them. So as they went over them, these horses were trained not only to run to the battle, but getting in the battle, they knew how to maneuver. They could go sideways, backward, forward, whichever way they needed to go to maneuver. And they would then also step on the enemy. And, you know, if you've ever heard of someone who's been kicked or stepped on by a horse, even accidentally, it can be very serious. When you've got these very muscular military horses doing this very often resulted in death. So this is what's in view, and the Arabians were better at this than just about anyone. And the early Muslim armies are actually using this training to advance the cause of Islam. They're moving like an invading army at a very rapid speed, like locusts. I want to look at Proverbs 30, verse 27.
Proverbs 30, verse 27. The locusts have no king, yet go they forth, all of them, by bands.
The locusts have no king, yet go they forth, all of them, by bands. And that really refers to the decentralization of the empire. This idea, they're not going to rule from this place or that place during this time. That really doesn't happen until Baghdad. Right now, they're advancing and they're establishing these Islamic communities, as I described before, where they would have people convert at the sword, and then these people would ride along and rape and pillage and do all the horrible things they needed to do to subjugate other people, and eventually they would leave this person and that person in this town or that town to reestablish what would now be a revitalized village that practices Islam. Revelation 9:8.
And they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions.
The hair is the hair of women refers to the fact that the Islamic invaders, unlike a lot of the other people, the Romans, for example, or the Greeks, the Arabians, they had long hair. It was long flowing hair. And it, very often they had it wound up under their turbans for purposes of battle. But they had long flowing hair, which is why it's referred to as being like women. And they had teeth of lions. If you remember back in Joel 1, when the discussion was, in Joel 1, the discussion, the description, I should say, of the locust, it was a description of locusts that had teeth like lions. And the reference is, I think, twofold. In a very straightforward way, what they're saying is these locusts may not look like they can do much, but locusts in the Middle East, a swarm of locusts can descend on a field of crops, and in a matter of minutes, it can be stripped of everything and they move on. So the reference has to do that both with this idea that they have the strength or the power to conduct their warfare, and it's combined with this fury to destroy. Locusts, a swarm of locusts, is utterly destructive. Nothing stands in the way of locusts. The locust will flatten any field, any target they have. And this is what the Islamic invaders are doing. Anytime they turn on a target, that target is doomed. They overwhelm it. They destroy it. They leave behind a few people to reestablish it as an Islamic community. It's been devastated. This is how Islam is spreading. Revelation 9, verses 9 and 10.
Revelation 9:9-10. And they had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots
of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months.
So again, we are told that they've got breastplates of iron and the sound of wings, like the sound of chariots of horses running to battle. We're told that there is, in fact, a system of self-protection in view. They're protecting themselves as they go, which is exactly what they're doing, the way they're doing it. Destroying any men along the way who are not going to cooperate. Not leaving men in their hometown where they might have an opportunity to rebel or in some way to resist. They move them on. And they don't leave them off until they've remade their friendships and their families. So there's a self-protection going on, and the conquest is rapid. Now, when we talk about the tails like in the scorpions and stings, we're really, what's being signified by that is that throughout these early conquests, they're inflicting the poison of their religion. You know, if you in fact are overcome by them, and they don't just kill you outright, they're going to poison your soul. You're going to be set upon an entirely different kind of being hurt. Revelation 9, verse 11.
And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon.
An angel of the bottomless pit. In the Hebrew tongue his name is Abaddon, in the Greek tongue his name is Apollyon. He is death, he is the death. And this is the true king of these locusts is Muhammad. He is a lieutenant of Satan. You know, his strength is out of the pit. Even after Muhammad dies, these caliphs are going to refer to themselves as the vicars of Muhammad. You know, just like Romish priests, or the Pope refers to himself as a vicar of Christ instead of Christ. They're standing instead of Muhammad. It's an analogous relation. So that they are, in fact, acknowledging that he is still the king. He's still their king. He's the one to whom they're answering. They're representatives of him. They stand in his place. They're his substitutes. Revelation 9, verse 12.
One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter.
One woe is past. That is, the judgment has fallen on the Eastern Roman Empire. And that judgment is, in fact, the rise of Islam. The next woe also has to do with the Eastern Empire. And the final woe also will have consequences for the Eastern Roman Empire. So these woes, these last trumpets, the last three trumpets, and the woes they bring, they have a different message and a different outcome from the trumpets, at least the first four trumpets in the West. It's a little bit different what's going on here. All right, Revelation 9:13.
And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God.
And what we have then, two things that John does here, is a sixth angel sounding, the sixth trumpet. This is the second woe, by the way. This is coming now. And he hears a voice from the four horns of the altar, which means he's hearing a voice coming forth from the presence of God. Now, what is signified by the golden altar is very much like that that was signified earlier in the book of Revelation by the golden censer, or the prayers of the saints, and they're cast down. There was a corrupting of the worship of God. That came to an end with the spread of Christianity. Christianity overturns heathen worship. Judgments of God on heathen Rome bring to the fore that true worship of God, knowledge of the true God. Here, the golden altar represents the gospel, and this is a punishment. These woes are being carried out as a punishment for corrupting the gospel. And just because we're at a second woe doesn't mean that the effects of the first woe aren't going to be felt. In fact, they are. This is going on for some time. The results, or the effects. The effects of the first woe last really until the rise of the Turks, which we'll see in just a moment. So even though that 150-year period was a limitation that was placed on the locusts, the first woe actually carries on quite a bit longer, because, as we'll see in just a minute, there's a different time period now that's going to come into focus. We want to look at the sixth angel, what the sixth angel was to do in Revelation 9:14, and as well the four angels that are listed or spoken of there.
Revelation 9:14, saying to the sixth angel which hath the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates.
So the sixth angel, the point of this is to loose the four angels bound by the great river Euphrates. Now right there, that language tells us that we're talking about a prophecy that has reference to the Middle East, what we would now call the Middle East. And the four angels that are bound, the four messengers, refer to the four Turkish sultanates. It really referenced the rise of the Ottoman Empire. Now, they start to appear somewhere around the year 1281 AD. And I'll tell you why in just a moment we date that, because there are a couple of ways to go with this, the numbers that are given us in the next verse. So let's look at the next verse, Revelation 9:15.
And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men.
Okay, so we have an hour, a day, a month, a year. And if we work that out in terms of a year for a day, we're dealing with 391 years that are in view. Now, I think there are a couple ways of doing this. One is we could count from that 1281. That 1281 is important to the Ottoman Empire because that's the year that Osman I of Iconium is elected leader of the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire is going to take his name from Osman I. And that would take us to the year 1672. During that time, the sixth trumpet basically subverts the East. And actually, in the year 1672, it reaches as far, probably as far north as Islam has ever gotten, by getting into Poland. 1672 is, in fact, the Turkish invasion of Poland. So that's 391 years. But I actually think that there's a better time frame here. And a little bit more to the point if we understand that this is judgment that's being unleashed. And while Osman I is going to be the first, the beginning of these four Turkish sultanates that that established the Ottoman Empire, I think we're better looking just a little further ahead to the year 1292. The reason is this. 1292, there are a couple of important things that happened. One is, in the year 1292, we have the end of the Crusades. The last crusade comes to an end between 1291 and 1292. Now, that creates an opening for another expansion. So, although Osman I is being positioned before this, the opportunity that arises doesn't really arise for the kind of expansion that Islam is going to make until 1292. But there's another thing, and this is really what brings Osman the first into the spotlight of history. The Mongols in the year 1292 actually expel the last sultan of Iconium, which is right smack dab center of Turkey. Iconium is actually the home base of Osman I. And so, this time between the end of the Crusades and the Mongols expelling, this creates the vacuum for Osman I to be moved into the front of history, and provides him with an opportunity to make another advance for Islam. Now, why is that important? Well, 391 years from this takes us to the year 1683. And the reason that is important, if we understand this is another expansion of Islam, something very, very interesting happens at that point. In 1683, after expanding into Europe, Islam reaches Austria, particularly Vienna. And in reaching Vienna for the first time, Islam is turned back from Europe and driven out of Europe. So that this 392 years is another expansion of Islam, but it never manages to get a foothold in the Western Empire. The reason for that is the Western Empire, the Western part of the Empire, is really where the Western Antichrist will arise. And Islam's job in the providence of God as Eastern Antichrist has to do with punishing the Eastern Empire. Let's look at Revelation 9:16.
Revelation 9, verse 16. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them.
Yeah, 200,000. It's actually possible that there are different figures out there for the numbers of Islamic warriors, Ottoman warriors, that were involved in this expansion. It may well have been upwards of a couple of million, which at this time in the history of the world was a huge number. Most armies never approached this. And a huge number, because of their training, a huge number were actually cavalry. So you had a lot of horses. And that's all part of the prospect that lies before them. They're moving rapidly. They are subduing. They're brutal. As I say, 1672, they get as far north as Poland. And then after that, they start to recede. But the thing that really kicks them out of Europe is what happens in 1683, when they're defeated at Vienna. And that's the major pushback. Keep in mind, had the Christians not ended the Crusades, Islam wouldn't have felt itself at liberty to go into Europe itself. If we were to look at maps as to what happened during the Crusades is the only time in the history of the world where Islamic outposts in Europe were actually turned back during the period of Crusades. So when they stopped, it probably looked like a very good opportunity to go into Europe, thinking that the Europeans would roll over and that it would be easy to take Europe. But they found that that wasn't the case, and it drove them all the way out. They were pushed all the way back. Now, I'm going to talk about something in a moment, talk about why they were so enthusiastic. And that is, right in the middle of this period, this 391 years, in the year 1453, there was a siege of Constantinople. It's now known as Istanbul. And there were people from the West, and even at the Pope's instigation, who went to help the Byzantine Christians. But it was too little, it was too late, and it turned out to be a fiasco. Islam ended up overrunning Constantinople in a very short period of time. And that has remained Islamic to this day. Which again is why I say the purpose of this, these two woes, the fifth and the sixth angel, the two woes, is in fact to punish and subjugate the Eastern Roman Empire. And we'll see the reasons why in a moment. All right, let's look at Revelation 9:17.
Revelations 9:17. And thus I saw the horses in the vision and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and jacinth and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone.
Okay, so what do we see here? John sees horses and men sitting upon them, those who are sitting on them. And he's told the breastplates are fire, jacinth, and brimstone. What those colors are red, blue, and yellow. And that's significant because the military uniforms that would have been worn by the Ottomans were actually red, blue, and yellow. These are the colors of the Ottoman Empire and its militia, its military, its armies as they're invading and going into these different areas. This idea, what we should understand about the horses, these horses which were fierce and they had heads of lions. These are fierce military horses, like I described before. These are horses which are trained not only to carry you into battle, but to help in the battle itself, to help fight. These are horses which are trained killers. And nobody did this better at this time than the Ottoman Empire. This is why they're overcoming wherever they're going. They have another advantage, and it's alluded to here when there's this talk about fire and smoke and brimstone issuing out of their mouths. And that is, brimstone is sulfur. And sulfur is one of the ingredients that's used in that's used in making gunpowder. Saltpeter and sulfur and so on. The fire and the smoke, if you've ever seen the old rifles, the early guns that were used, there's a lot of smoke when they're going off in battle. There would have been, you would see fire coming out of the ends, you would see smoke. The whole battlefield was full of smoke. You ever seen a reenactment of a Civil War battle? They were still using similar weapons even until that period of time. And those battlefields just become filled with smoke because of these guns. You know, you see fire, you see smoke, you smell brimstone, you smell the burning of the gunpowder. That became associated with these Ottoman armies as they're advancing. These are wars of expansion. They're on horseback. They're using the latest weaponry. They have tactics which are extremely effective. You know, when you go in and you kill all the men who resist, you convert the other men at the edge of the sword. They're not allowed to remain in that city. Now you've left behind men who are going to take their wives, their sisters, their mothers to be their women. Probably not going to be as inclined to go back and try to kill everyone. You don't want to kill all your people. And they don't turn you loose to do the same thing until they know that they have assimilated you into their way of thinking and belief and practice and so on. Right, Revelation 9:18.
Revelation 9:18. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths.
Yeah, so what is in fact in view here is Islam nearly extinguishes the gospel in the Eastern Roman Empire. Doesn't matter how far the gospel had gotten there. Churches are destroyed. Christians are killed if they won't convert. They're not left alone in these periods of expansion. Later on, when Islam is really sort of established, they will tolerate a small amount of Christian descent or what have you, but not a lot. And it's probably mainly just a matter of propaganda. Because during these expansion periods, they're simply brutal. And they managed at this time to extinguish strongholds of Christianity all throughout what had been the Eastern Roman Empire. Revelation 9:19.
For their power is in their mouth and in their tails. For their tails were like unto serpents and had heads, and with them they do hurt.
Yeah, the power in their mouth now and in their tails. Well, this could be referring to the use of cannons, just like the guns. They used cannons in the siege of Constantinople as early as 1453. There's a lot of gunpowder they're going through in battle. But it could also have and be sort of a double entendre and refer to the preaching of Islam. You know, what they're doing, they've got power in their mouths. But their tails now, they're not like scorpions. They're really like serpents. The fact is, what's being pointed out is not only the poison that is Islam, But we're being pointed to the fact that Islam is a devilish religion. You know, the poison of it is that it arises from the bottomless pit, that it is a work of the devil, that it is, in fact, something that is harmful to the gospel in these areas. Revelation 9, 20 and 21.
Revelation 9, verses 20 and 21. And the rest of the men, which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor their sorceries, nor their fornication, nor their thefts.
So what we come to find out is those who are not destroyed by these invading armies, that is to say, those who didn't become Muslim, who remained Christian in the East, we're told that they didn't repent of their idolatries. And the reason God's pouring out judgment on the Eastern Roman Empire is this is a judgment against their idolatries. Remember, the East, more than any other part of the church, promoted this idea of image worship, beginning with the Second Council of Nicaea, really prior to that, but they make it a conciliarist matter at that point. So although this has happened, this judgment's been poured out, it doesn't dissuade the Greek or Eastern Orthodox Church to abandon idol, this kind of image worship, these icons. This has brought about the judgment, but they're not dissuaded. It doesn't dissuade the West from making statues and all of that. So the result of these two woes being poured out upon the Eastern Empire, in the end we find that professing Christians, whether Greek or Latin, continue in their idolatry. And in this state, they're actually awaiting the seventh trumpet and the third woe. So it's not that nothing will come of this. But when we get to the end, you would have thought that Europe, having dodged Islam in 1683, would once and for all have learned and have repented and turned back to God. But they don't do that. They're not dissuaded from the course that they're on. Now, isn't it interesting that one of the most pervasive effects of Islam, wherever it is its prohibition of any kind of image. Islamic art consists in mosaics and geometric shapes. They have taken the prohibitions of the Second Commandment to the most extreme possible position you could make it occupy. They won't depict anything in the creation. And that actually has to do with their doctrine of Tawhid, the oneness of God. They don't really understand the creator and creature distinction. And so they're afraid to depict anything in the creation, lest they might be found to depicting God. But this is a judgment that's poured out on a church that refuses to worship God in the way that He's appointed, that insists upon the use of icons in the East and statues in the West. So God's judgment on idolatry, the idolatry of the church, is Islam. Now, you might think that the next chapter, it would be the natural place to bring up the seventh trump and the third woe. But it's not. So next time, we'll take up what's said in chapter 10. We're going to enter into a little interlude where we'll have to describe some things so that we can get a better sense of the identity and the duration of the Western Antichrist. Chapter 9 is about the Eastern Antichrist. Trumpet 5 and Trumpet 6, Eastern Antichrist, Islam, Mohammedanism. And this is all tied in, if you remember, back in the book of Daniel. The third kingdom, the Greek kingdom, was divided into four after the death of Alexander. And out of one of those areas, we were told that there would be a little horn that would arise, a different horn than the one that would arise from the ten toes to the ten kingdoms. That he would speak fierce, he would be a king of fierce countenance and speak dark sentences. That's what's being described here now. And I think it's significant that Islam arises in the East, that is, in that section that was pointed at in Daniel, where this horn would arise. It would be facing the pleasant land, Israel. It doesn't arise in the West, where those kingdoms are. It arises in the East, and it comes out of, and actually has reference to, not the Roman Church, but the Greek Church. And it's a punishment on them for their icons and their image worship. All right, next time we'll look at chapter 10 and talk about the interlude we find there.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.